Thanks for waking up with WKOK Sunrise on News Radio 1070 WKOK and WKOK.com.
And thank you so much for joining us on WKOK Sunrise. Mark Lawrence here. Rob Centers on the other side of the glass, so everything's at the right spot, and everybody's got their good jobs going here and taking good care of us this morning. We're glad to say this morning we're meeting for the first time and are going to talk about an important topic with Dr. Scott Purinton. He is the Division Chief of Gynecology Oncology at Geisinger. So good morning, Dr. Purinton. Thank you so much for calling in.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, very good to talk to you. I think this has got to be a brought up and talked about issue. We're going to talk a little bit about cervical precancer, but also invasive cervical cancer and the increased prevalence of that. We talked to Mike McMullen, one of the good outreach people up at Geisinger a while back, and when he said increased prevalence, I kind of shook my head. I thought I certainly knew that the numbers were going down lately. So, first of all, let's lay the groundwork. Cervical precancer is going to be some of our focus today. Differentiate that from invasive cervical cancer, certainly the most deadly, one of the most deadly forms of cancer we do know about.
So, yeah, when we say cervical precancer, so the screening test that we use for cervical cancer, the Pap smear, is a test that is used to detect what we call cervical dysplasia. That is, for all practical purposes, precancer. So that essentially is when a healthcare provider, the test actually involves scraping some cells off of the cervix and sending them for a cytopathologist to look at. The goal there is, you know, the Pap smear was really designed to detect cancer before it's cancer, if you will. So in other words, when it's in the precancer state, so we can intervene early on. When it progresses to cancer, typically the treatment at that point in time is going to either be surgery or possibly a combination of pelvic therapy and or pelvic radiation and chemotherapy, depending on actually what stage the cancer presents at.
Now, is that why you're teaming up with the American Cancer Society to sort of redouble awareness to testing and screening and diagnosis, really trying to get this Pap smear even more common in our lives?
That is correct. Yeah, in January is actually Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. We want to get the word out because cervical cancer, you know, in the United States should be nearly eradicated if all women have access to screening, if they're compliant with screening, and actually getting the HPV vaccine. Cervical cancer should be able to be nearly eliminated. I say nearly because, and I'm sure that this will come up, you know, cervical cancer in most cases is caused by a virus. It's caused by the human papillomavirus. There are, unfortunately, HPV independent cancers that obviously the vaccine is not going to protect against. So that's why I use the terminology nearly eradicate.
Explain that in further. HPV independent cancers, sort of dig into in lay terms what we want to know about that.
So most, you know, I would say 99%+ of cervical cancers are viral driven. So they're caused by the HPV virus. Cervical cancer, if you will, you could actually consider a sexually transmitted infection, which just simply means that you get it from exposure to HPV, and then the HPV manifesting itself in a way that basically eventually forms a cancer. Now, with that said, you know, I've referred to HPV as a ubiquitous virus, which just simply means that most, if not all, people are exposed to HPV. HPV in itself does not have to cause cervical cancer. So most of the time, if your immune system is healthy, you can be exposed to HPV and it not cause a problem. But if you are immunocompromised, there are cofactors as well. For instance, women that tend to use or abuse tobacco, smokers, if you will, have a very difficult time clearing the HPV virus. The HPV independent types are they are exceedingly rare in 20 years of taking care of patients with GYN oncologic malignancies. I've only encountered a handful of those patients. That just simply means that, you know, the pap smear may not actually pick up those types of cancers, but they are few and far in between.
One thing that you and your colleagues have noted is the importance of safe sex for everybody, no matter how many sexual partners an individual has. Is that still critically important for us to talk about?
100%, absolutely. So the, you know, simple things being simple, for instance, like barrier contraception, the use of condoms, very, very effective at preventing transmission of HPV. You know, along with that, when I give lectures on cervical cancer, you know, we talk about anything that's basically going to increase your risk to HPV is going to increase your risk for cervical cancer. So not only unsafe sexual practices, but, you know, doing this with multiple partners as well, obviously, is going to put one at risk. So condoms are a very, very effective way to decrease your transmission of getting HPV.
Can a male be tested for HPV to find out if they might spread it?
Correct. It's the male, I would say men are probably not usually tested to see if they can spread it, but I do want to point out that the vaccine that is FDA approved, it's approved for boys and girls between the ages of 9 and 14. HPV is usually attached to women's health and cervical cancer, but HPV actually can cause cancers in men as well. So men actually can be tested, and men can be, can be vaccinated as well.
You mentioned that there is an increase, not a decreasing, but an increased presence, prevalence of cervical cancers today. Tell us about this trend.
So I think the trend, I think we have to be careful, because I don't know if we're probably diagnosing more cases, and we're diagnosing more cases in an advanced stage, and that probably can be explained, unfortunately, with people not accessing healthcare during COVID. So, you know, current guidelines, you know, for pap smear screening is women should start at age 21, and then depending upon that pap smear result, a woman may not have to come back for 3 to 5 years, depending upon what age bracket they're in. Unfortunately, what I've seen since the initiation of the COVID pandemic is that women are actually more afraid of COVID than they are of cancer. So that equates to them not coming in and being screened. These dysplastic lesions are turning into microinvasive lesions, and hence turning into invasive cervical cancer. So when women come in, we're diagnosing more younger women, and unfortunately they have later stage disease because of, you know, not coming in and being screened due to the COVID virus.
Well, tell me more about this age range. I think you called it creeping in one discussion, that it is changing. Is that also because of the increased testing, or do we have more prevalence?
Well, the average age of diagnosis for cervical cancer in general is 35 to 44. We do unfortunately see, me being a GYN oncologist, I see the worst of the worst. So I really see it across all age brackets, but I definitely have noticed since the COVID pandemic, I am seeing more younger women basically come in with early, actually, and advanced lesions.
All right. Well, tell us what you are doing for those women these days. We certainly have seen, laparoscopic or robotic surgeries and other treatments. Do you have more tools in your tool belt these days?
So, yes. typically when when women are referred to me, usually they have already been diagnosed with cervical cancer, because the pap smear screening is usually administered by general obstetricians, gynecologists, and actually I should say some family medicine doctors, and even nurse practitioners and physician assistants. It's a very easy test to administer. So basically when they get in my office, they usually have not only had an abnormal biopsy, but then had a biopsy of the cervix indicating that they have cervical cancer. Now how I take care of these women when they come to me, it all depends upon what stage they are. So cervical cancer is unique when it comes to gynecologic malignancies. And what I mean by that is the patients that are candidates for surgery and radiology would be patients confined to the cervix, that spread to the adjacent tissues. They are no longer, they would be a candidate for a combination of pelvic radiation therapy. So mainly is in the third, a lot of these topically. You have to carefully, since the utilization of robotic assisted has been data to suggest that women that undergo robotic assisted laparoscopic surgery may not do as well as patients that have traditional, what we call open hysterectomies, when we make an incision on the abdomen and basically take the uterus out that way. I think a lot of that has to do with the skill of the surgeon, the surgical volume, that they do, and basically choosing your cases appropriately. I still do a lot of these cases. I do as many cases as I can, minimally invasive, because literally hysterectomies have become an outpatient surgery for women when we do them laparoscopically. So we try to choose wisely up front and choose the best procedure for the patient on a case-per-case basis.
What do you want women to do?
I think it's important for women to establish a relationship with their healthcare provider early. And what I mean by that is, obstetricians and gynecologists and health practitioners that do gynecologic care, we acknowledge that this is a very personal field. We totally get it that nobody looks forward to coming in and having a pelvic exam, and there's anxiety when women come in for these visits. I think establishing care early, I think, helps out a lot with that. Pelvic exams, for the record, are usually not painful, uncomfortable exams. They do not take long to do at all. So I just would encourage women to seek out care early, initiate pap smear screening at age 21, and if possible, become vaccinated before exposure to HPV. That's normally going to be a parental decision, obviously, but if you have kids, I know my daughter, when she turned 9 years old, got the HPV vaccine, and I think that's the best, that, and living as healthy a lifestyle as possible, because again, cofactors like smoking and having a healthy immune system is very, very important. So I think the three things are initiate and be compliant with pap smear screening. The second would be vaccination, and the third is do everything that you can to maintain as healthy a lifestyle as possible, and that's going to be your best defense.
Well, you and all your peers have the same shtick on that last one. Lead a healthy life with some diet, fitness, and exercise controls in there, and it seems to really just have so many correlations to so many diseases. Well, Dr. Purinton, thank you so much. There's so much to cover in this important topic, and I'm just going to say right now I'm going to invite you back on the show in the weeks or months ahead, or maybe I can come up there and sit down for half an hour. I just think so much more has to be said about this to really talk about the latest and to make all this information 100% clear. So thank you for the sample today. We will be back in touch in the months ahead. Thank you, sir.
Yep, you're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. That is Dr. Scott Purinton. He's the Division Chief of Gynecology Oncology at Geisinger. And originally, we just started primarily about the cervical precancers. They're doing some profiling of theirs of individuals to identify likely cases. And, of course, the DNA research is going on in the labs as well to try to sort of dig into what's the genetic, this catalyst that seems to happen for cervical cancer. Dr. Scott Purinton on the line from Geisinger.